And welcome to Bloody Goodreads. I am your host, Mark Goddard. You'll know me from the Snakebite Horror website and Snakebite Horrorcast and the several million podcasts I seem to have got myself doing nowadays. We are back with a brand new episode and a brand new guest as well. So we've gone to the other side of the world again with Aurora for this week. She is the author of the brand new book over in the UK, Petra's Ghost. And she's also a crime author. And from the look at her website as well, she's into a bit of true crime. Welcome to the podcast today. Our guest, C.S. Okaneda.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm glad to be here. All the way from Canada.
Canada's done. We had one other person from Canada. So
we're making
our way around the world.
Well, given our population, then there's probably two other people and you got us all.
It's a nice end of the world. You're kind of part UK, part Canada. It's fine.
Absolutely. As long as we try not to look to the south of us too much, we're fine.
Ignore that part. Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast. So what we like to do here at Bloody Goodreads is force authors to pick free books, because I mean like that. But also just have a quick chat about your books, what got you into writing, etc. as well. So I'll start every week. What kind of genres, areas do you like to read, and how did you get into writing?
Wow, as a reader, I'm kind of like all over the map, but I think a lot of readers are, and that maybe that's why some of my writing is all over the map, genre wise. I think, you know, I'm a victim of my particular generation, and you can guess what that generation is, because we cut our teeth on Stephen King. So certainly that time of the horror paperback was a huge influence when I was growing up and when I was first reading. And so I think that had a real influence on me, and perhaps I look for fiction that's going to be, it's going to elicit some strong emotions in me. Mm-hmm. One of them being fear. the other might be a shock. I'm not a big fan of stuff that I think is kind of lukewarm. But that being said, I'm a huge literary fan as well, if that's a genre or whatever somebody wants to call that. I do enjoy reading and read probably a book a week or something crazy like that. Mm-hmm. Lately, I've been focusing a lot on crime novels because I do review them for my my website, She Kills Lit, and also I just enjoy them. But once again, I'm not reading the cozies, that's for sure. And it's in terms of how I got into writing, I think I've always written, but it wasn't until after 20 plus years working in the IT sector that I finally decided writing a novel wasn't that different than building a computer program. So I sat down and I wrote Petra's Ghost, and the rest is kind of history there.
How did you get the idea for Petra's Ghost? Was you a horror reader at the time, or
definitely a longtime horror fan, I'd had a few short stories published that were certainly in that genre. One about a psychotic teenager who cuts the fingers off of a classmate, and another one where somebody's iPhone gets possessed by the aunt, a maiden aunt, who helps her murder her husband. So, you know, obviously I was having these kinds of thoughts earlier, but Petra's Ghost, I just walked the Camino de Santiago in Spain, which is a 500-mile pilgrimage there. And I wanted to come back and write a book about it, but everybody and their uncle is writing a book about their experiences on the Camino. So when I was there, a woman vanished off the trail. She did not come to a good end, but my story was not really about her, but I decided I was going to write, you know, a dark thriller set on the Camino. So that way I got to write about it. But at the same time, I got to pull in something that was maybe a little bit more interesting and different than your average Camino memoir. But what was interesting about that is when the publisher picked it up, they promoted it as literary. And I kept saying to them, you know, what about the creepy bits? But they kind of ignored those. But even 9 months before it came out, it was on some of the, you know, it was on Bloody Disgusting. It was on all sorts of places as, you know, the top 10 horror novels anticipated for the year. So, and it actually ended up being in the semifinals for horror on Goodreads. And I was beaten out by Stephen King. So
well, definitely... Everybody.
Yeah, people, somebody noticed those creepy bits, obviously. So that's how I found myself writing Petra's Ghost. Yeah.
Cool. And being showcased on Bloody Disgusting, that's a good feat. They're a brilliant website over in America. So, you know, one of the top horror websites. So you've done something right there.
Yeah.
Very, very creepy.
Yeah, and I knew I did something right when I started getting contacted by people who make films who said, I saw you on Bloody Disgusting and I like your book and I'd like to maybe make a movie about it. So that's when I knew I'd really arrived. But it was an interesting kind of way to come into that genre because I came in sort of in from the back end that way. But, you know, I always knew, you know, people would ask me what the book was about, and I'd say, oh, it's about this Irishman on the Camino, and, you know, he's tortured by guilt, etc. And then one day I was talking to Andrew Piper, who is a fellow, he's kind of considered the Canadian Stephen King over here, and I thought, you know, I'm going to come clean. He says, what's the book about? And I said, it's about, you know, a decaying corpse following a guy on the Camino. So... And there you go. I came clean. That's what it was about. Although I guess it was about a whole lot more than that. But yeah.
You get that a lot with the kind of literary horror. We had James Brogdon on the last episode, couple episodes ago. And he basically, when he was writing Bone Harvest, he was also classed as literary horror. So I don't know if it's just like with horror movies, they call it kind of, you know, certain horror movies aren't horror movies, but they have horror elements. But I don't know if that's what they kind of mean by that. But yeah, they can't cut out the fact there's a corpse following the guy up a mountain. So they've got no way around that one. So they have to call it horror literature.
I think a lot of publishers and people are afraid of the word horror. You know, they think of it as a dirty word. And that's unfortunate at their peril. I do a course here in Canada sometimes. I call it How to Write Frightening Fiction because if I said how to write horror, I wouldn't get as many people. But the interesting thing is that I think you can put horror elements into any kind of writing that you're doing. And I had little sweet old ladies who write romance novels who were really excited by some of these frightening elements because we weren't going to call them horror elements, but we called them frightening elements that they could put into their fiction. And they were delighted with them. It really spiced up what they were doing. And so, you know, I think that less so these days that and I think the publishing industry is starting to realize that people enjoy these kinds of stories and always have. So, you know, maybe they'll be less afraid of the H word from here on in.
Hey, you have it in the film world as well, especially around Oscar time. Was it Get Out was a huge hit, but nobody wanted to call it horror, even though it was a horror film. But I know that kind of horror genre in general is now starting to get a huge resurgence, so it's always cool to see. But the crime side of it as well, I mean, crime and horror is such a thin line between the two that there's probably more gruesome scenes in crime novels than there is in horror novels a lot of the time, which is always a strange thing to think about because where I worked for Waterstones for years, and the crime novels being the biggest seller had more of a female audience, and it was always an older female audience as well. So they're kind of like saying that the kindly old ladies they like a nice crime drama. So very, very fine line there.
There's certainly a lot of middle-aged women reading crime novels. There's a lot of middle-aged women reading, period. So, avoid them at your peril. And that's one of the reasons I think I wrote the crime novel that I did that featured this 6'3" hit woman who was kind of an avatar for every woman who wanted to, throw a bad guy up against a slushy machine to get him to get in line. So that's kind of where that came from. But there's a lot of graphic stuff in the novel in terms of violence and not just violence. I often think that some genres like horror, like hard-boiled crime or noir, they're just more descriptive. Mm. So you just don't say there's a body there. You get into detail about that body. And some people call that graphic, and some people call that realism, and some people call that, good detail and good writing. So what can you say?
Right. And that's the thing. And you want detail in your book. You just don't want to say, there's a body there. Okay, in the next chapter. You want the detail. It kind of really helps you delve into the book and kind of really sets you in, kind of drags you into the story. So
yeah, and I think it lends itself to the whole novel. I think that novels that tend to be light on those details tend to be light on all the details and tend to be, a little less deep. And that's okay. Sometimes that's what people want. They don't want something that's going to describe a lot of stuff to them. But, for people who like to really feel what's going on in their novels, I think that's more than line of the kind of thing that they want. And certainly the books that I enjoy reading are, some of them in terms of crime fiction, people that I love are like, they're more from your side of the pond. Denise Mina, for one, the tartan noir queen, and Tanya French. Mm-hmm. All women who never just say there's a body there.
She's a brilliant writer.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean you have to get into flowery language or anything like that. I mean, like I said, when you look at someone like Stephen King, who to a large extent, started the whole craze of and interest, at least in the 80s, in that kind of fiction and in horror, he used simplistic language, but he used it beautifully and rendered incredible situations and emotions from his readers without ever having to write in a way that you hurt your brain. So
a great place to segue, actually. As you know, on this podcast, we make our guests pick three books. So what is your very first bloody good read?
My very first bloody good read is maybe going to surprise people because I'll call it a bloody good read. But it's simply the book that frightened me more than any other book I ever read. I read it in my early 20s, and it is The Handmaid's Tale.
Brilliant choice.
By Margaret Atwood, a proud Canadian like myself. There's where the similarities end, because she's just incredible. But 10 years ago, a lot of people wouldn't even know what I was talking about when I was talking about The Handmaid's Tale. It came out in the mid-80s. It's a dystopian novel, no argument, but particularly for women, it is horror. Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think the reason, and Margaret Atwood and some of the other things she's written, like Oryx and Crake, that's her kind of eco-horror series. It's all speculative fiction, but it's all frightening stuff, because Margaret Atwood will tell you that there is nothing that is in her books that has not already happened or is about to happen or is trending to happen. And thus it's all the more possible. And I think that's the sort of thing that really gives people a fright, that really, that's why domestic, domestic noir and everything is more popular now, it's that feeling, hey, this could happen to me. You know, that makes it all the more real, right? I don't know. You're probably familiar with The Handmaid's Tale because it's been made into an incredibly popular series. Yep. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Mark, on whether that it can, is horror or not?
See, I've never seen the series. I will admit, I've never seen the series.
You've never seen the series? Oh my goodness. Do you know the premise, though?
I don't. Strangely, I don't. It's one of the series that kind of passed me by. I know it's what I kind of class as more human horror, the kind of the horrors that people can do.
It's supposed to be, well, it's supposed to be set in the, you know, in the not so far away future, where, you know, women have basically lost every right they ever had. And, to my mind, reading it as a young woman in my 20s, I can remember thinking, oh my God, this could happen. And it's often been compared to the kind of the gothic sense, because, you know, it has, you know, the entire, rather than one imprisoned female in a tower, there's like an entire, you know, the United States is imprisoned women in a tower. And Margaret Atwood actually there was a term coined, not by me, what they call Southern Ontario Gothic, a play on the Southern Gothic, you know, that's famous in the States. But we've got some writers in Southern Ontario that tend to kind of go with neo-Gothic themes and of that nature. And I always felt The Handmaid's Tale was one of those. And it scared the crap out of me as a young woman, because it kind of made me realize how possible it was to have to lose everything and more in terms of your rights as a human being. And I won't go into detail of some of the particular scenes that got me, you know, terrified, but they are there. And she describes them in great detail, and they are a nightmare.
I've heard it's quite dark.
Well, and you know what? I haven't watched the show either, and I'll tell you why I haven't watched the show, because I'm too scared to watch the show. So I don't know how closely it goes. It follows the book, but believe me, the book was enough to make me a feminist for the rest of my life.
And that is understandable.
So that was kind of my first one. Do you want to hear my second one? Do we want to talk more about The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah, let's go into your second bloody good read. Let's just see what else you pulled on.
Well, my second one is technically not a one, and I don't know whether it's cheating, but it's kind of a collective of kind of the neo-Gothic short story, because I did say earlier that I cut my teeth on Stephen King because that's my generation. But my mother had a really, she was an English major, and she had a really incredible library. And I was very bored as a young kid and had an ability to read beyond my years. And she had such classics. But some of the classics she had were The Monkey's Paw and the collective stories of Edgar Allan Poe. And I remember reading The Monkey's Paw. I was probably 6 or 7, because like I said, I was reading beyond my years, and blatantly tried to plagiarize that in school.
We all do.
By writing a story that was almost exactly like it. Some of these, and later, you know, you get to discover some other voices from that sort of neo-Gothic short story of, The Yellow Wallpaper, not to get on my feminist bandwagon again, but it's just a great story, by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, where a woman is basically driven mad, by, you know, having to stay in her room and rest, and starts envisioning some kind of hideous spectre behind the wallpaper, which really ends up sort of being her. But she tears the room to shreds, and possibly her husband.
We're all there, you know.
Yes. Well, and that's what I was thinking, actually, because I went back and I read some of these stories, right? Because I wanted to refresh my memory. But because, you know, I read them when I was a kid and I loved them. And, you know, I read A Pit and the Pendulum and I read The Raven, which is still, you know, it's great poetry, but it's just amazing. Yeah. And one of the stories was The Mask of the Red Death by Poe, I just read recently. And it's where this Prince Prospero takes, you know, him and 1,000 of his best friends lock the doors on the castle during a plague and try to ride out the plague in there, you know, eating and drinking and having orgies. And and basically the Red Death comes for them anyway. And boy, did it ever... was it ever apropos for the current climate? So I don't. And apparently they did have these balls back in the day. Poe didn't come up with that by himself. They actually used to have, you know, like plague balls where they would just hang out and party for a long time and try to stay away from peasants with the yeah. virus.
We can't have that over here.
Yeah, and you're thinking, I know you're thinking, Mark, you're saying, boy, there's some people I could name who are doing this.
There's probably many places in the UK that do that. We're on full lockdown here in the UK at the time of recording. So, yeah, I'm sure there's many,
yeah,
many
little... Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. It's illegal over in the UK to do stuff. So,
yeah, there's a will.
You can't go around and see your partner.
And, you know, I have a daughter over there at Oxford because she's the lower achiever in the family. And, yeah, she's none too happy. You can imagine as a university student, she's none too happy of the idea that she can't go to the pub with her friends. So I think she's expanding the definition of her household daily. But anyway, you didn't hear that from me. All the kids at Oxford are obeying the rules, I swear to God.
Of course. So,
but I think a lot of those stories influenced my writing for sure, because I've had my writing compared by Publishers Weekly and a few others as like modern day Gothic, and I didn't even realize that I was doing that. So I think that I must have been heavily influenced by being locked into my mom's library with nothing to do on a rainy day and picking up those books, you know, and checking out those short stories.
Yeah, it's always look back at what you've written and gone kind of, yeah, okay, I can see why my writing's like that. I haven't written in ages. I review now. So you can't write, review.
well, even if you don't see it in your writing, you see it in other people's writing. I mean, The Pit and the Pendulum has been redone, I think, 50 billion times in everything from comic books to 007 movies, you know, the long, oh, you know, this person is going to die, but it's going to take long from this incredibly elaborate way that I've designed to kill them, you know, and it always gives enough time for the hero to ride in and save them. So that's an excellent plot device. But, you know, classic Pit and the Pendulum with Poe and the Monkey's Paw. I'm not the first person to when I was 7 or 8 to try and borrow on that. I mean, Stephen King and Pet Sematary lists that as definitely, you know, one of his inspiration for that novel. So, I'm mentioning Stephen King too much. This is too bad, but I told you, it's my generation. We can't help it.
Do you know what? You know, I've had so many authors on the podcast, and Stephen King is brought up in pretty much every episode. So you're not the only one.
Okay, I feel better now because, yeah, and you know, like, and you try to. There's, you know, a couple of really good books out there, and you probably know a whole lot more on sort of the history of horror, and I've really enjoyed kind of reading, you know, all the different eras and different types of writing that people were doing from, you know, from Frankenstein onwards, you know, and quite frankly, it predates that because I think they always say that there's every society has what, a creation story and a flood story, but almost every one of them has a ghost story, I'm pretty sure. So
one of the oldest saga stories, the ghost story.
Well, yeah, because you know, and as you know, there's all sorts of reasoning behind that, from trying to find a safe space to deal with our anxieties to just being human beings that like a good scare. I don't know, but yeah, so that was my second one, which was really sort of collective, that whole kind of neo-Gothic short stories that influenced my very, very young reading years. Awesome. And perhaps made me strange.
Not strange. As a horror fan myself.
I know.
I got goosebumps. You know, that's what we have here. In point
you
horror.
See?
I'm a 90s kid.
Oh, see now, and I had some 90s kids, unbelievably, but yeah, Goosebumps was a huge thing. And what was that? Did you have over there? Are You Afraid of the Dark? That was the other one that
we
was
had
on
that,
TV
yeah.
at the time, rather
that
than
was,
reading. I'm thinking
that was Nickelodeon.
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
Yeah. Throw the little sparks onto the fire. Oh yeah, you know, and Tales from mm-hmm. the Crypt. Once again, I'm getting more into TV and filmography, but Elvira.
Yeah, I mean, we never had Elvira. We never had.
These were great times.
We never had like Tales of the Crypt and Elvira in my era. More kind of no. Had it over here. Creepshow either. I mean, Creepshow is more now. Because obviously Creepshow is, they rebooted it on Shudder, and we're getting that over here. Even Twilight Zone, it's out of my generation, sadly. Horror kind of took a dip. I mean, when I was kind of more of my teen years, Scream came out. So that was kind of the big resurgence. And obviously I had Halloween, and I know, mine was more movies, kind of the horror genre kind of got me into that. But yeah, it was mostly a lot of Goosebumps and a lot of kind of Stephen King. But he's kind of every generation Stephen King.
Yeah, every generation Stephen King. And they're coming out with a new Scream. Did you know that? I have that from my insider Hollywood types. Yeah, there's going to be a remake of Scream, which is interesting because, of course, you know, there's a whole kind of reveal going on there. And would it be as good if you don't have that reveal? So I'm assuming they'll do something similar to the remake of Pet Sematary. Mm. Yeah, where they kind of change it somehow. But yeah, that's movies. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time was the whole Anne Rice novels at that time and things of that nature. So there was a lot of stuff going on. And then it was quiet for a while. And I think that the movie and the TV, it really does drive the books. And we're lying if we're saying that it doesn't. And things like Scream did turn things around, I think, for the horror genre. And also making movies that made incredible amounts of money. so that people thought, hey, if I can invest, like $10,000 in making Paranormal Activity and get the greatest grossing horror film of all time, practically, or film of all time, then maybe that's worth it. Maybe actually there's people out there that like those kinds of stories.
Just don't like to admit it.
Yeah. And like you said, people like literary horror, whatever, that, you know, I think of things like Lincoln and the Bardo and stuff like that. You know, people are borrowing, you know, all sorts of things from the horror genre. And making it theirs. So maybe that's kind of a unique reworking of it all. But I suppose that brings me to my third book, which guess what? It's by Stephen King.
And that I didn't see that one coming, strangely.
Oh my goodness. Okay, but it's The Stand. Which is another one kind of like Margaret Atwood that you could argue is not exactly true Stephen King horror. It's it's dark fantasy, or it's post-apocalyptic, or it's whatever it is. I found that book on the floor of an older girl's car when I was like 15, and I took it home and I could not put that sucker down. And if there is ever a book, which I don't know whether Stephen King was looking into a crystal ball to the future, But yes, everybody's destroyed by plague and we're left but nothing but the good and evil at war with one another. So,
it's like the Nostradamus of the new generation.
he definitely is. It's an incredible. But that book just floored me. And I had read other Stephen King, which was interesting, you know, prior to that. But I had not read The Stand, and it to this day, it is one of my, you know, top 10 books for sure. If we weren't living it now, I would say that, you know, that the terror elements were amazing in it, but it was just so well done. And once again, I think that there's that gothic, influence in it. You know, even the aspects of religion that were in it, without being preachy, but the good, wonderful 108-year-old Grandma Moses character that's leading up the good side, talks to God a lot, and the main protagonist isn't a religious guy or anything, but there is certainly, whenever you see a showdown between good and evil, there's that aspect in there. And so often gothic themes have some aspect of religion in them, usually not for the good. You know, it's usually some evil monk.
It's quite the monk.
Still, yeah, and I think that's Petra's Ghost has been, you know, called a gothic quite a bit. How could it not be? It's written on it takes place on a pilgrimage that's been around since the Middle Ages, and every time you turn around, there's gothic architecture and gothic art and gothic everything. And plus, it's just weird to be walking the same path as people have done, probably predating Christianity, in some sort of spiritual quest, you know. So you know, those elements are there too. But yeah, The Stand had a real effect on me. I don't know what your stand is on The Stand, Mark. What's your stand on The Stand?
One of the only Stephen King ones I haven't really tried.
This is why I love this podcast. Between that and The Handmaid's Tale, you got some reading to do, boy.
This is episode 13. My list is growing every week.
It's true. Although I hear he did a re-release of it, or a republication of it, where he added in all sorts of bits that were not in there before. I have not read that one, but I think it's 1,300 Jesus. Pages once one gets to that point. And I'm sorry, that's probably just a little too much of the stand.
It's thick.
But
I can't do an extra long stand.
Yes, well, it beat it when that one was published in terms of the lengthiest Stephen King novel ever. So I'd go with the original, but you know, I tend to be a retro kind of girl. The Stand had a deep effect on me in terms of in dark fantasy and dark tales. And I probably plagiarized that in English class as well. You know, I'm obviously a plagiarizer. Maybe I shouldn't be a writer at all.
Inspiration, not plagiarize. Inspiration.
It is inspiration. But I think a lot of writers, a lot of young writers, I have people come to me sometimes with their work in progress and asking me to have a look at it. And I think we practice when we're learning by writing like others. And it takes a while to find your own voice. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I see sort of sometimes in new writers and young writers, is they're writing in the way of somebody or other.
And that's why it's always good.
And it takes them a while to find.
It's always good
voice.
To kind of mix up what you're reading as well. A few authors I spoke to on previous episodes have said, you know, they're horror writers, but they particularly read horror. They read so many different, like, fantasy, sci-fi, because if you stick to one genre, you'll make your writing stale. Kind of, you can take parts of different genres and put it into your story. It can make you a better writer as well.
Yeah, I think you're really right on that. I had one writing teacher tell me once that they never read while they were actively writing something because they were afraid it would influence them. And I said, wow, that's why I do read while I'm writing. You know? Is because sometimes I think it's helpful. If I'm thinking that maybe things are not having enough description, enough detail, that's when I'll often pick up a literary novel, you know, and I hope that it sort of infuses my work with a little more beauty if that's what I was looking for. If I'm wanting something that's going to give me, you know, a rough and tumble feel, then, you know, I'll pick up some down and dirty, gritty crime taking place in Glasgow where somebody's stabbing somebody else with a blowpipe from a, what are those things they use? Yeah. Bagpipes. That's right. Those are my ancestors. I should know these things. Well, some of my ancestors. Obviously, there's an Irish connection, as you can tell by my name.
No, I mean, I remember when I was writing, when I was younger, in my kind of my teen years, I was a huge Buffy and Angel fan. So did a lot of vampire novels back then. So a lot of mine was kind of, you know, based on kind of stuff I watched. Mine was a lot more watch than read, especially older, because some of the stuff that I have read is a lot more darker and not the type of thing I would like to write personally. Always, you know, my top three books are Jack Ketchum's Girl Next Door, which changed me forever. It's heartbreaking. One of the only times I've ever cried reading a book.
Okay.
Wouldn't recommend reading it. It's very, very hard read, but it's one of the ones that kind of got me more into kind of non-Stephen King horror. Then you got Jess Strand's Dweller, which is a brilliant book about a boy and his monster, which is brilliant, brilliant book. And Curious Incident with Dog in the Nighttime. It's my third favorite. I love that book.
That is a wonderful book. Yeah.
Second time I cried at that book. The end of that book is absolutely heartbreaking. And I never normally cry while reading, but the two books have done it, them two books. I mean, Gothic writing as well. Wasp Factory by Ian Banks is an amazing book. That's in my top five. But yeah, I like to try and kind of mix stuff up. When I was kind of writing myself, like when the short story I Have You Had published, I was very into slasher movies, so that's where I kind of started doing my more slasher movie style kind of short story, and it got me published. It's all good.
So what's your favorite slasher movie?
Scream 2.
Scream 2?
Always Scream 2. It's Scream 2, yeah.
No, really?
So it's Scream 2. I always say it's one of my favorites, and I'll always stick to that.
See, I thought you would pick from one of the, like old, like, I don't know, Black Christmas. See,
Black
not
Christmas,
in the remake.
Black Christmas is amazing. I love Black Christmas, the one that really kicked off the slasher genre.
Yeah, no, and that was filmed right here in my hometown, Toronto, Ontario, you know, with who was it? Anyway, the main actress went on to play Superman's girlfriend. That's what that I remember. Black Christmas was a classic,
which we are covering on my film podcast in a couple of weeks' time.
Are you the remake or the 70s original?
The original, of course. I've seen the remake. It's awful. Both of the remakes are awful. No, I mean, I was brought up on Halloween and Friday the 13th, all the main kind of horror genres. But Scream 2 has always stuck with me. I think it's because I remember watching all the Screams with my mum, and you know, when she was alive, she was a huge, huge horror fan and a huge inspiration to me, kind of, especially ghost stories and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I just remember watching them with her, and you know, no problem with the gore. It was all the nudity. He's like, no, hide your eyes, can't watch that bit. If you had all the kind of, you know, good memories towards it.
Yes, it was strange that way, you know, what we would tolerate and what we consider indecent or not. And I showed my own kids some of those older horror films. And what I was amazed by when I watched them, you know, 20 years later is how campy they were. You know, I mean, I can remember I wasn't able to sit through the movie Goodfellas because the violence in it was too much for me. But I would happily watch, you know, Jason go after people because it was too, come on.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I think that's where we get into the realism aspect. I mean, how real do you want to be? And, you know, and how much can people manage? And when it seems too much like something that could, you know, happen, not that, you know, I'm going to get tortured by the mafia or whatever it was in Goodfellas or by gangsters. Some of those things were a lot easier to handle, mm-hmm. and certainly were adult themes, but I don't know. And some of them were just wonderful. I love it when people try to do something and different and tongue in cheek. And I love when there's humor and stuff. There's tons of humor in my crime novels, as much as that they're really hard boiled. They are full of like really funny stuff. And, and I think of things like Shaun of the Dead and Tales from the Hood by Spike Lee is still one of my favorite horror films. But but I'm just weird that way. I like it when people take something and they make it a little bit different.
Yeah, no, totally.
You know,
agree.
And I think that that's partly where Petra's Ghost got the attention that it did, was that nobody had done this. And actually I was just kind of surprised that nobody had thought to put a dark, scary, frightening story on the Camino de Santiago, despite all the books that are written about it. Mm-hmm. So it was like taking your traditional haunted house story, but you were haunting a whole pilgrimage, you know? Yeah. At the time, I did it because I wanted it to be different, but I don't think I quite realized how different it was going to be. And unfortunately, I've pondered it for a few years now, something that I could do that could be just as different, but unfortunately, I can't come up with it. So my next novel that's going to be more in the horror genre is called Eve's Rib, and it's going to be about a psychotic teenage daughter, which has definitely been done, but it's just always good material.
Awesome. Three really, really brilliant reads and some more reading for me to do. A lot of reading when it comes to the stand.
Yeah. Although I should have called it bloody, bloody good movies, because I'm afraid I've referenced more horror movies than I've referenced horror books. But a lot of the typical. I read V.C. Andrews when I was growing up, those Children in the Attic. And as I mentioned, Anne Rice was a big one for me. But, you know, of course, Shirley Jackson, when I first read the Lottery, I almost fainted. I mean, I was not because, it was scary, but it was certainly had its scary parts. But just it was just so brilliant, you know. And, you know, and I didn't come to read her novels until much later in life. And they're very different, but I love what she does with, and I find it very, very interesting that she also wrote humor. So she wrote these incredibly dark, pathological stories. And then she wrote humorous stories about like her kids. Those were the other novels she wrote. So I often think that horror and humor are just, you know, they're very close cousins sometimes.
it's the trio, very isn't it? It's a trio. Cousins. It's crime, humor, and horror, all in one little package.
Yeah.
I was always a crime novel fan. While working kind of through Waterstones, I kind of discovered more of them, like Mark Billingham, and he's one of my favourite crime authors. And it's British, and I'm British, and we like a gritty drama over here. We like them gritty. But then, you know, I'm a huge fan of the TV show-wise. I'm more a fan of stuff like Castle, because I love Castle. Okay. I think it's hilarious. Yeah. But, you know, I like him as an actor, though. But there you go.
Sometimes you have to switch it up, right? Because in reading and in viewing pleasure, because, you know, I find if I read noir like exclusively for a couple of months, I'll start to get very depressed, you know? As much as I like it. So then I got to switch it up for something different. But and same thing with TV watching. You know, we went through a whole Sons of Anarchy phase here, which we were really into. And now we seem to be offsetting it by watching Golden Girls and Southwesterlies.
you need that wonderful thing to kind of set.
Well, my husband's become a fan of Southwesterly. He's from he grew up in Limerick in Ireland. Mm. So it's, you know, it's supposed to be in Cork, so that kind of does it for him. But those are connections. So we're over there quite a lot on your side. As you said, Canada is a bit of UK light. So we've got a lot in common. And I've got enough family over there between kids and in-laws that we're over in England and Ireland a lot. And of course, Scotland, I said, oh, it's awesome. Beautiful, beautiful spot.
I live here, yeah. Okay. I want to go to Canada, really. I do. I like Canada. Well, rather not be in the UK at the moment.
It's a beautiful country. No, yeah. it's a beautiful country.
The further north,
despite
you go,
having one of my, well, you know, every one of my in-laws is afraid to come over here because of the cold. Like they're always frightened of you know, coming at Christmas, for instance, because you know, like they hear negative 20 Celsius and they start to lose their minds. But actually, the part that they find the hardest to handle is our summers because it's so darn hot. It's really, really hot. And we can have like 43 degrees Celsius with the Humidex, which is really, really hot here in the summer for days at a time. So y'all think you got to grab your parkas when you're coming to visit us. And what you really need is your flip-flops and your Mai Tais for a better part of the year. But then it starts to get cold.
Awesome. So we know what you're working on next. Where can people find you?
Where can people find me? Stuck in my home like everybody else, Mark, right now. people can find me at shekillslit.com, where I spotlight generally on women writers of thriller and noir. And also, as you've noted, I do some true crime there. I have a lot of fun doing that. And so you can find me on shekillslit.com, and you can find Petra's Ghost at Titan Books, anywhere you buy books around there. And hopefully I'm hoping you're going to be able to find me on the big screen soon, because we have been talking to people about a movie version of film version. And actually, I believe I'll probably know more in the next couple of weeks on that. So watch this space. Nice. We're pretty excited about that one. We're pretty, because it's a very cinematic kind of book. Mm. So a lot of setting going on, you know.
Hey, so be nice some more. We'll get you on the film podcast as well.
Wouldn't that be fun?
See, I run a free podcast. I can get you on one of them.
Great. And then we can talk about more of these movies, because I seem to be able to rifle those off better than I can than the books I've read. That's the problem when you read too many books. You read one a week, you can't remember any of them that you've read, or the authors or anything else. You just remember that you liked them.
Hey, look, I run one book podcast and two film podcasts. It ends up in a film conversation at some point, so you're all fine.
you're a busy guy. Jeez.
And you
write yourself.
Used to. Always kind of float around the idea of going back to it, but you know, you got a young family and work, and you just run out of time. So I podcast. It's a lot easier.
Well, that's well, and it seems that you're pretty successful with doing that as well. So
thank you.
But so there you go. And you know, for most of us authors out there writing, if we're not Stephen King, you know, this work will get, and 25 cents will get you a coffee. So it's
brilliant.
So it's got to be a labor of love. That's exactly. For sure. As I'm sure podcasts have to be as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I get paid nothing for this. I do it because I enjoy it. That's pretty much what I do.
Yeah, but I meant less that and more that, you know, the kinds of things, even if one is successful monetarily with any of these things, it has to be something you enjoy. And
exactly.
I think even when I set up my website, when I set up She Kills Lit, I had to, sure, you know, one is supposed to have an online presence. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I was doing that, full disclosure, but also I did it because it would have to be something I enjoyed. If it was something that I was forced to do, and I see some authors doing that, they're doing their blog spots or they're doing whatever because their agent told them they should, or their publishers told them they should. But I find that these things work a whole lot better if you just really do things that you enjoy. And so I enjoyed reading and I enjoyed talking about those kinds of books. So I thought, hey, here's a way to do it, you know?
That's the best way of doing it. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a really, really cool episode. I've really enjoyed this episode. So thank you so much for coming on. Please go out and buy Petra's Ghost. It's a brilliant book. I'm reading it right now and I'm thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying it. So a review will come up on that one at some point in the next. I'm a very slow reader, so soon. I can't say when. But yeah, so again, thank you for coming on. Always, you can find us over on Twitter at Bloody Good Reads, Instagram at Bloody Good Reads, and over on Facebook if you search Bloody Good Reads. Come on, have a chat with us, talk about your favorite books, and get into conversation there as well. You can catch me every fortnight as well with Niall and Marcus over at the Snakebite Horrorcast, where we try and review films in the best way we can, which is not great always. and also every other week on the Franchise Players podcast as well with me and Chloe. Still going through our Child's Play series. So we just did the record for Bride of Chucky, which should be out by the time this episode comes out. And we'll be going on to Seed of Chucky and going through the sequels on that one as well, up to next year when we're doing Indiana Jones, because, you know, technically it has horror parts in it. That's my excuse. So as always, thank you for listening to the podcast. And again, a huge shout out to our sponsor every single week that they sponsor us on this podcast, Abominable Book Club. It's the book subscription service we keep pushing over on Instagram and Twitter as well. They have two different tiers. We have the just a book box, which you get a brand new book and a secondhand book. And you also got the full set box as well. You get a brand new book, the secondhand book, magazine with a short story writing. You get coffees, teas, a snack from the UK, and all the other little cool little bits and pieces in there. So yeah, head on over to Abominable Book Club at cratejoy.com. The description is in the box below. And yeah, use the code BladyGoodReads to get 10% off as well and the checkout. So go give it a try out. It's a brilliant little box. If you want to see what we've had before, heading over to Instagram and Twitter. Myself and Niall have just showcased what we just had in the box as well. So yeah, go and have a look and enjoy some cool new reads. And as always, I've been your host, Mark Goddard, and I'll see you next time.